So Jerry, I want to appreciate, thank you. Thank you very much. Always, I'm not completely comfortable with saying that everybody's here because of me. That's much ado about nothing. So I hope to show you that this weekend. Okay, so first of all, you always touch my heart. I always feel very I'm at home here, not only because of the many lives that I've connected with over the years, but the sense of the building and the history and just Seattle in general. It's just a very fine and firm spiritual home for me. I hope you feel the same about Sims. It's very hard for me to come back and teach and then take the Donna personally. And the organization means too much. It's like you've got to give, you know? And I hope that spirit is in you so that you keep this thing alive. It doesn't matter, the teachers will come and go. You know, ones that you connect with, ones that you don't, doesn't matter. Just keep it alive. Keep it sustained. And through your donations, through your benevolence, through your kindness, it survives. So this is a benefit weekend for the sustaining quality of this organization, for any Dharma organization. I mean, how can you look at what, you look around us, we're an island of sanity. We're an island of truth. I mean, Dharma. We're growing. We're not staying small. This thing is filtering out. Many of you are teachers in your own right and are spreading the Dharma in ways that you understand. So this thing is moving out, and it has to. We have a lot of counterweight to balance. So be generous in your donations, and it's easier for me to be able to ask for that generosity when I'm not the recipient of it, that Sims is. Okay, so I have a friend who's staying with us from out of town, and she said, I just want to say one thing. She says, I think I'm going to be on the verge of tears most of the weekend. Just don't let it bother you, okay? It doesn't bother me. It's what the heart does. So she said, I just want to say one thing. She says, this book has re-excited my Dharma practice. And I thought, wow. I wish she had written a... It was the best compliment that anyone could give, you know, because it reinvigorates, re-energized. So let me, I want to talk to you a little bit about that re-energetic quality. Because if you stay too long, there's a placidity, there's a way that you can become dull in this. And it was my attempt for the years I was teaching never to let that happen, to always challenge. And it's only through challenge that we can be pulled out of our dullness. If you stay too long in what's comfortable, you get dull. That's all there is to it. Now, one of the things, this has something to do with what I just said, so it's not that I'm getting old. I am taking, you can go to UW and take classes when you're 60 or older. So I'm taking an astronomy class, auditing it, basically. It's for free. So, astronomy, right? I like it. And so there's an analogy that I want to try to communicate about what the stars are and where we're going in this thing. And early on, even in the middle of the 20th century, mid-1900s, 1930 actually, you know, we knew the solar system, and we knew this galaxy, but we thought that was it. The galaxy, Milky Way, was the entirety of the universe. And we thought it was permanent in some way, that it wasn't in transition, that it was going to remain pretty much a galaxy through time. And we knew all the planets, and we had a realization that, you know, we were no longer the center, which earlier, 300 years earlier, we thought we were the center with the Earth, everything rotated around the Earth. And so that loss of self-centeredness allowed us, because it would have never, it was a spiritual growth actually, which led to a scientific understanding that this, we actually revolved around the sun. And so we got our place in the universe, and you know, there were 9 planets, and we were all happy. And the sun was, we were going around the sun, and we could let the sun be the big dude, and we'll be just one of the rotating. Okay, so that was. And then the galaxy was discovered, and then Edward Hubble, in 1930s, found out there are other galaxies besides our own. And suddenly, the sense of our place in life began to spread much thinner. In one way, it felt like we were much more isolated and alone than we ever used to be, and everything was much bigger, which emphasized our smallness. But in another way, we began to sense that all of this was reachable, that all of this was available to us in some ways that it hadn't been. And so the sense of connectedness began to expand outward. But we still kept ourselves rather rigidly tied to the standards of science in those days. And we didn't really venture out into some of the properties of space and time until Einstein came along. And he started to show us that what we thought was so consistently true wasn't. That space was not space and time, time, but there was space-time. And then as our optics improved and we could see further into and out into the vastness of things, and we began to discover qualities of the universe that upset us. Like it's expanding at an ever-increasing rate. Like there are black holes of mystery. Ones in the center of each galaxy, supermassive black holes. And there are exploding stars. And there are neutron stars and quasars. And white dwarfs, and even the 7 dwarfs. And so the whole thing started to get very unexplainable. It was as long as we were on the Earth and we were looking out, and the sun was, you know, okay, everything's got the sun, you know, fusion, all that, and planets, okay, Mars, and okay. But now, as the reaches of our, as we expand our reaches, and this has a spiritual analogy to it. As we expand out beyond what our comfort range, beyond what we just know to be our home, beyond what we have taken to be our fact, we touch areas of the universe that are unexplainable to science in this day. To aspects of the universe of time and space that we can't explain. We don't know how to navigate that, to the sense of space itself, to what space is. And to me, that's why I took an astronomy course. I don't really, it's wonderful that we have a sun and that we're rotating around it and, you know, but that's not what I wanted to touch. I wanted to touch the wonder and the mystery and the expanse. I wanted to touch the unreachable. I wanted to touch where no teacher could tell me what was going on. I love that. Because then we're all meeting in exactly the same place. As long as he's telling me on a board, drawing it all out, then it's too didactic. It's too him and me, or her and me. But when it reaches out beyond where we all meet is in the wonder. That's where we all meet. What are you going to say about it? You can't say anything. You meet in the quietness of that. We meet in the quiet. In the absolute stillness of knowing nothing. You see? And so now, we're in the Dharma scene. And many of us got into the Dharma scene rightfully because we were confused. We didn't know what life was about or how to make our minds work, and everybody was telling us what we were and what we couldn't be and what we should be. And we come into this thing very confused, mixed up, just not being able to settle ourselves. Where am I in this life? What am I in this life? And those questions have to be settled. We can't go take you to a black hole and expect you to settle down. Your consciousness will not settle down on the rim of a black hole. So this book, this is a long way of getting to the topic at hand. This book is meant to be unsettling to you. And so when someone says it makes them excited for the first time, it means that they're being unsettled. They're moving beyond their script, beyond the solar system. They're moving into areas that only a fool would go. And we're all fools. And so I love it when we get excited, because the opposite of excitement really is fear, is dread. But we have to be able to walk that edge in Dharma. And if you take the solar system from what we've known about it from ancient times to the middle of the 19th century, 20th century, middle of the 20th century, much of Dharma has stayed within that packaging. It's relied on what people have said about it through the editing of it, through the elaboration and the endless commentaries. And all of us then get into the Dharma and we know our solar system. We know how things spin and what, you know, we know, and the Buddha said this, and he's the one we rely on to give us the information, or Jesus, or Muhammad, or whomever you're. But we haven't ventured far enough. We haven't made this thing into an edge for us. Because that edge is our aliveness. It's the edge of our aliveness. It's the edge of our expanse. It's the edge of the capacity for us to receive. What you begin to realize is that we're all very protected in what we receive, filtered, boundaried. I'll let this in and not that. One of the things that's truly a fascination, and this is in the last 15 years for me, is the sense of prejudice I have with everything. I'm not prejudiced, I've been in a Dharma, you know. And you awaken to the fact that everything holds a prejudice. It's called an opinion. Not just people, genders, but everything. And so as we put a boundary on everything. Why? Because we want to know where the moon is and where the sun is, and we want to know Mars is the next planet out. And our opinions allow us to maintain that certainty. If you have an opinion about everything, that's it. The deal's done. It's sold. And it holds me in place, confirms me through my opinions. Our opinions confirm us. They're not statements from us. They're statements about us. And so we stay within our solar system. And yet that's not the Dharma. We have to become less confused. There's no question. And the solar system provides a basic guide to grounding ourselves out of that confusion. Because you know where things are, you begin to know who you are. You begin to know, okay, so this is my role in life, and this is the way the universe is laid out, and etc. But the Buddha's first noble truth did the same thing. The first foundation did the same thing. It established us. You see? No matter what century we're talking about here. And that is incredibly important for most people. But we can't stay there. It establishes us. It says, you are here. Wow. To really be here, if you're really here and you look around, there's a sense of our place in here that's confirmed. It's like, well, what am I doing up here? I don't know. What are they expecting from me? I don't know. Now I'm not here. I don't even know the ground is under me. I don't. This confusion has got to be tamed. It has to be centered. So much of Dharma, because we're such a confused society, I hope everyone realizes that this is, okay, this is said politely, and I know I'm being videotaped, but this is an insane country. When we have to have a gun for sanity, to establish our sanity, give me a gun. So we have to find our sanity in other means, in other ways. And this beautiful step-by-step approach that the Buddha is taking to establish ourselves, first in the body, because he realizes, well, nobody's coming to the Dharma with less than confusion. They're all coming confused. I've got to settle this out. So what's the first thing I'm going to do? I'm going to have them land in their body. I'm going to have them know that they exist. Ah! And the first touch of awareness confirms our existence. We might not like what we see. That's because we've fostered the confusion so that it's our conditioned reference to life is confusing. But this is the way towards sanity, is to at least acknowledge one's existence. Now I exist, I can see what I exist, what's within this existence. And if it's true, then okay, I'll be a confused person the rest of my life. Fair enough. But if it's just believing that I'm confused because other people have told me, or that's my conjecture and that's my opinion about things, oh yes, I'm a confused person, I can prove it because my third grade teacher told me so, then we need to relook at that. And so when we land, We land in the middle of our confusion. And so many people have been weighted in that direction of being confused or not having a place in life or not having any worth in life, that their entire Dharma practice is an attempt to rebuke that conviction. And no matter how far you go in Dharma, there's still this tiny belief that it'd be so. Haven't you noticed that? You think that's ever going to go away? So you can loosen your confusion. You can uproot much of it. But the last vestige of it depends upon something else. It depends on a black hole. It doesn't depend upon the solar system. It depends on reaching beyond that, reaching into a new universe, a new set of ideas, a new understanding of what life is built upon. Because the hardest thing in us are the assumptions we make about ourselves. They are the things that are the... And it's not until you work with it in the loving and kind ways that we do through much of the beginning initiation of Dharma. Very important, I'm not in any way debating that. But it's not until the thread of that becomes so thin that you see through it as meaningless because it's empty, that we can completely uproot this confusion. Otherwise, we're just kind of developing another conversation, another opinion to try to thwart the one that we already believe in. And you can't ever completely convince yourself of that because there isn't enough proof around. Even if everyone in the world told you so, you'd still have your own opinion of what you knew and you were fooling everybody else. We stay too long in the solar system with just what we know. And the other reason is because we're terrified of going outside of it. It's better to love what we know and don't like than to venture away from that. I used to keep a sign on my desk that said, it's better to be wanted by the police than not wanted at all. So part of what we need to arouse and to compel forward is our conviction, is the conviction that we can be more. And the body does that for us. Because the Buddha doesn't stop with the body and all the imprints that are there. He doesn't say, okay, just be in the body now and just... It's, for so long I was in the body, but all the body just was giving me the same information that I already, you know... It's like I was grounded, I was developing a steady focus on the body. I knew my place in life, but the sounds that were being emitted from the body and mind were pretty much what they'd always been. Except now I could add a spiritual opinion to it. But the Buddha doesn't stop with opinions in the body. He says, move into the body without knowledge or remembrance. Whoa, wait a second here. This now I'm talking, I'm on the edge of a black hole. I don't know this universe. But you see, at the same time as we're working in conjunction with the physical fact of our body, we're also working in more quiet areas with what the mind represents, or what we now know the mind to be. And we begin to see it from a different configuration. It's not that the thoughts are us anymore, they're beginning to be shown in a different light, that they're a conditioned reference, and I'm not thinking my thoughts at all. They're just being expelled from the neurological display and hardened conditioning of my past. That's it. And I just am constantly re-believing what I've already believed. Re-opinionating is what life is about. And that's called karma. We re-opinionate ourselves. And we think somehow this is going to stop. That somehow, we don't have an understanding of what spirit is. We don't understand that. We don't know how to find spirit. That's why I broke this book, not in terms of suffering and not suffering, because that's part of the old solar system way of view. It's beautiful. But it's like, okay, I know that. I know all about that. No, yeah. It's like immediately you slump. Oh yeah, right. It's like, right, what does that have to do with, you know, what? I've gone through that one. I know that story. It's like reading a book to your young child on the 20th time, you just, well, and Joe said, and the child's doing the same thing. So we need something to move us beyond the frame of reference that we have for ourselves. We can't keep recertifying ourselves year after year of Dharma practice. I'm getting better, I'm getting happier, I'm looser, I can move more, I can, fine, it's wonderful, but are you free? Are you free of the entire inward logic of your mind? Because that's what freedom is. Or is it easier? Is it better logic? Because you've been disputing it, it's going to be better. You've been showing it to, you know a little more about thoughts, a little bit about how the mind works. You have some space around those thoughts. You're going to feel better. But that's just the solar system. Now you can fly between planets. You see, this is where I want to push you. We only have this one life, and don't give me this thing about, oh, I don't know that, do you? And if I've been doing this for as many decades as I have, likely you don't know that either. We don't know we don't know that. Don't use that as a way to assuage your lack of attention. This is compelling. And this is what I can be assured I'm here, and I can be assured I my existence, and I can be assured that I can do what I can do now, and I don't know anything more. I don't even know if I'm going to be alive tomorrow or well tomorrow. But I do know today, and I do know now. And as I begin to narrow in that concentric circle of the logic of tomorrow, of endless time, it begins. One thing that happens, many things happen, but one thing that happens is it's like a tuning fork of sincerity. In a tuning fork of confidence. I can do this. Well, nobody else has got more of the now than I have. I don't care who they are. Buddha did not have more now than me. I've got equal share of now, which is called all of now. But you don't understand my conditioning. I don't care about conditioning. That's happened. If you're talking about now, don't talk about what happened. What happened, happened. Fine. That's moving through you. That doesn't have to uproot you. So now is no longer confined. It's not a limited now. It's not, there's nothing on either side of it. It was only a very shortened now, an impoverished now, when it was up against where I'm going and where I've been, and what I believe about myself and what I hope to believe about myself. But now that there's a sense of the movement of what I am from the past into the present, because you can't stop that . But also basing ourselves in the present, you can surrender, release the past from the present. And then we begin to touch the sacred. Now it's close at hand. When it's confused by the past, when I believe my opinions, there's no sacred. The sacred has been obstructed, obscured by the past. You can't see anything except your opinions. That's why I frame the reference of the book not from suffering to the end of suffering, which again is a beautiful, but from form to the formless. In a different tradition, if we were Zennies, I would go suffering to the end of suffering, because that's not the framework of the Zen. Zen is from form to formless. But we're not Zennies, or many of us, so I'm going to take us out of our system and put us in a very valid and equal system. And I'm not going to go into all the ways that they're equal. It's in the book. On one of the first chapters explains how those two systems are identical to each other, so that you're not losing something by going to form and forms. And what's that anyway? Well, what it is opinionation, beliefs, conjectures, ideas, which is form. That's what makes form form. That's what makes you and me. That's what makes any object an object, solid. To spirit. So what's the conduit? You see, it's already there. It's like, oh, if I talk to myself all the time, I'm formed. Therefore, if I shut up, if I'm quiet, if I learn. But you can't force yourself into being quiet, because you're just repressing the noise. You see, so this is where it gets tricky, and this is why it seems to take so long. I mean, if it was just will, I'll just repress can't do it anyway, but you can try, and many of us have, that sense of antagonism, resistance, just builds up more noise in you. So you have to learn that the noise has no bearing upon you. Then you don't care. You don't care. You don't care. It's like the buzz of the, like, who cares? And then the mind opens up beyond the noise, not confined by the noise. As long as it's confined by the noise, we're believing in the noise. As long as we're believing in the noise, we are the noise. We are the noise. We rise and fall with the amplitude and connotation that we give the noise. But when the noise is seen as just being neurons firing or whatever, then we're not confined there anymore. It's just the mind. It has to know that, and this is the reason Dharma. It's an engaged practice. Like I've learned all the words that I knew, but like neutron star and white dwarf and brown dwarf and black holes and, you know, all of that stuff. You know, you hear it, but I don't know how they all pieced, I don't know how it all pieced together. How's it all, what's that have to do with? But then you go to astronomy class and you learn how the evolution of the star systems, and you, it all fits in very nicely in an intellectual package. But that doesn't change anything in me. And that just gives me an intellectual satisfaction. And many of us have rested far too long on intellectual satisfaction. Read books, listen to the teacher, this teacher, this teacher, this teacher. Now you're, when the teacher leaves, when the book is finished and read, now you're on your own. You should be on your own to ask pertinent questions that only you can ask yourself. And so this is an engaged practice. We have to actually go in. You see, the mind isn't going to release itself from words if it has an intellectual understanding of words, because that's using words to understand words. It's still tied to words. It's not going to let go of words when it's using words to decipher its universe. It's not going to do that. You have to understand the value of stillness and quiet, that which holds the words, which is the sacred, to be able to release yourself from the word. Does that make sense? I mean, this is not astronomy. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done, and that's the hard work of separating form from the formless. This is really exciting to me. You'd think, why is it exciting to you? You've been doing it for... My astronomy teacher gets really excited, you know? Like, I love that, the passion, you know? He gets really going on it because he loves the subject. Well, think how much a Dharma teacher loves the subject when they're in it. Not just talking about it, you see. So that's why, for me, a true passion is a resonance of Dharma teaching. It's just something that comes out. And as we begin to be able to steady our confusion, in many ways, one for the physicality of the body, just knowing that we have a place in life, we have a ground, we have an anchor. And despite all the logic of people in the past telling us to leave, to get out of here, you don't have a place here, what are you doing here? The belittlement of our place in life, the fact remains that we have a place in life. The fact. Not the conjecture. We formed all the other stuff, all the input into a conjecture, but this is the fact. My feet are on the ground. Anybody want to dispute that? That's an unassailable argument. An unassailable fact. Now I can take my rightful place. I don't, going on inside is all this other stuff, but at least I know my place. I have a place here. This is where I am. What am I? That's yet to be discovered. But here I am. This is where I am. Now let's see what's going on to create the confusion, to interest, to move beyond our accepted self assumptions. Oh, I see, you know, if I look at my past, I don't spend a long time deciphering somebody's past, but you can get a feeling very quickly by just running your mind across your history where these self-conjectures and assumptions came from. You don't want to spend a lot of time blaming that. That doesn't help at all. But now you see, oh, it's conditioning. If it was given to me back then, it can be extinguished now. A conditioning is beautiful that way. It does not permanent. It can be uprooted. If I believed in it once, I can disbelieve in it. It's like if the chicken pecks the light, you don't give it any food anymore, it stops pecking the light. The conditioning's gone. Okay, so now as I settle into body, I do it with a new spirit, a spirit of adventure, not of like, oh God, what am I going to find? Oh, not of fear. And it's like, who cares what I find? Who cares what I find? When it was a system that was imparted to me, I didn't want it. I just accepted it because I didn't have any other alternative. I didn't know better. So now I can uproot this thing. To me, that's optimism. That's hope. That's everything, really. And I've got this, I've got my fundamental existence of body to confirm that I'm in the rightful place with the anchor, with the touch of creation, with a part of the earth, with a part of the universe. You touch one part of the universe, you've touched it all. First thing I have to stop believing is that I don't have a right to be here. Because the fact is contradictory to that, the fact of my body. Now I have to release that message. I have to just release it as it comes in, and I've never, you know, on all the memories, I just phew. Okay. There is a time for therapy, therapeutics, that's fine. It's kind of a bartering system where you're getting people at, in its best to listen to your self-discomforts so that you could uproot them and expose them into another person's point of view so that they don't remain hidden and shadowed within your own. But it's the self-assumption around that that is the most important link that perpetuates it. And that link has to be broken. But I've got all the tools. And so now as I sit and the confusion reigns, I make space for the confusion. If I do anything in relation to the confusion, there's essential points that I'll be making. As many of you know, I hold up my finger and do something that's... And well, this is one of them. I can't remember the point I was going to make. What was I talking about? Tools? Okay, so... I don't remember any of that, but I'll just start talking from there. So as this comes up, you don't, I got it. You don't react to it because the reaction is the past saying something about the present. All reactions are what we've learned about what the present is from the past, and then we react to it, which compounds and reconditions the present into the past. I hope you follow that. That's it. That's what's called life. That's called our life. So I'm wise enough to know not to do that. So the stuff comes up and you what? Where do you go, you see? Anywhere you go in mind is reconditioned. There's only one place you're driven to if you see the absolute truth of what I just said, and that's to the sacred. Because the sacred's the only thing that can let something go completely without any conditionality or judgment associated with it. And believe me, when you know the sacred, you will know love in its purest form. you will know love in its purest form. And for some time, you will say, oh, I've never been loved like this. And it will be your own heart, your own heart's expression to yourself. It's the sacred holding the limited. Not disputing the limited, which is what we do when we still believe it. We dispute it. I don't want to believe it. I don't want to believe that. I don't want to believe you, Mom, Dad, Uncle Jim. I don't want to believe you. But you do. And it's not until the sacred, which is just the absence of form, it's just the absence of opinion, it's the space of stillness. I hope some of you can feel that space touch as we talk, come down, descend. That's all wrong, but it's a nice metaphor. It's not descending upon anything. It's here all the time, but let's just say it's being experienced. You can see why someone would call it the Holy Ghost. Because it's not available through sight, sound, and smell. So it's ghost-like, and yet it's holy. And it descends. And suddenly, because when you step out of the logic of our own internal configuration, we step out of our boundaries, out of our limitation. We step out of all the boundaries that have kept us in body and in form. And guess what that is? That's the universe in its true form, which is formless. Okay, all. That'll get us rolling. Okay, so I just want to kind of wrap this thing up a little bit in terms of our direction. We're moving from form, which is the only thing we know, if we're honest, most of us, when we begin, we only know form. We only know, you know, what we have known life to be and ourselves as a product of that learning and of that knowledge. And that sense of me operating within form is another formation that I've learned along the way. And so the sense of I is built upon the moment after moment recognition and memory of who I've been in similar moments all along the way. So that's why I can navigate this, because I've taught here before, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so that's formation. That's also suffering, obviously. If I only know myself from the past, I'm never available to the present, not really available to the present. The difference between the past and the present is suffering, is dissatisfaction, because you're always alone, you're always separate, you're always distant from where life is, which is the present. And so we keep buying into the past displays of our mind as recognition of ourselves, and in so doing, put ourselves behind life, never able to catch it up. Just always one grasp ahead. Well, if I just do another sitting or another retreating or another this or another that, but never quite. Okay. So that's not, the Buddha doesn't do that. He just, okay, enough of that. Enough of that. We're gonna take you systematically. If you want this destination, we're gonna take you from it being a reach to it being, if you being driven, access, complete access and engagement within it. So the first thing he does is to show the recognition of the most common form we all have, which is the body. It's replication, it's common and true to all expressions of form, but it's the one that's most personally true to us, is our body. And it invites us in for an exploration, for a grounding, first of all, to ground out our confusion, to establish some sanity in our life, where we're not just being driven by whatever our mind says, but having some access to an existence that is not driven by thoughts and emotions, etc. Okay, that's what the body, and then he has this question, he even takes us a step further for those of us who are willing to go. He has this question, what the body is. Well, it seems to be, now if the most personal object we have only seems to be, what about the less personal objects we know of? They seem to be too. It's that seem to be that is the qualification. And he shows it through experience. He says, okay, so your experience has told you that your body is this, but when existence doesn't hold the recognition of what you've been in the past, it holds the present. The present doesn't have that seems to. It has the experience of it only. It has the fact of it only. So examine the body free of memory and recognition. Without memory and recognition, what is the body? Where are the boundaries I placed upon it? Where are the limits I've imposed? Where is the criticism and judgment I've invested in it? See, it all just goes. But I think you don't understand. I've lived my life that way. I need it back. Well, you can have it back. Just go back up here. It's all there. But if you want to be free of it, you do so, most of us, by recognizing that this is being carried and contained within a certain frame of reference. And anything that's within a certain frame of reference, called my memory, my past, it's not going to be absolutely true. It's going to be referenced true. What I've gone through in my life, you don't understand the mother I had, the father. Okay, that's your reference for claiming yourself to be what you are. That's the reference. To step out of that reference, all you have to do is to see that you're not, it's not with you. It's not here. But you're carrying it along. You're reminding yourself, I don't remember, I'm miserable. I'm miserable. I'm miserable. Oh yeah, no, I'm not happy. I'm miserable. Don't bother me. I'm miserable. Yeah, okay, so we can do that. And it seems valid because our past shows us we should be miserable. So don't. Oh my God. There's another world out here, people. There's another world. Oh my. So as we begin to learn our way from the past, releasing ourselves, this thing starts opening up more and more. You can sense it. Inward space, outward space. And then there's a hard-driven past that still has, that's been so brutal upon us that it comes in with a shock and kicks our consciousness and embeds within that certainty that this particular aspect of me is true. And the other things I'm letting go of, but this one, you know, this is the one. And these assumptions have to be, with patience and diligence, are can also be released. And then you become full-hearted. Now to do so, that's the first foundation. We got three, and we've got four after. We have two mornings and two afternoons. So guess what? Guess what I'm going to be doing this afternoon is number two, the second foundation. The second foundation is most of us aren't convinced that the past isn't true. Yeah, we have our bodies, and we can kind of feel it and everything. But you know, when the money's on the line, I'll bet on my past, right? So the Buddha says, okay, I'll show you, we're going to explore. We're going to explore how the past forms itself. And you're going to see every single component of how that past forms the memory of you and the you that comes forth. And once you see that, you will be so engaged in understanding of that process that you'll say, why am I doing this? It's like, whoa, this is amazing. I don't have to do this. This is just the rat pushing the bar, the dog, Pavlov's dog salivating. This has nothing to do with anything. And that's why the second foundation is so critical, because it takes you into the engaged activity that creates the sense of the past as being you. And we'll talk about that this afternoon. But that's not the black hole. And we're heading towards the black hole. It's all black hole. We'll do that a little later. Okay, so questions or comments about anything? Yes, sir.
So, in the world of dreaming, I'm assuming, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's just another variant form.
Yeah, but be careful here. Calling it another variant form whitewashes it. There are forms that require more from us than just, oh, that's just emotion. Or we get too flippant, we get too impatient with it. This thing has to burn out of us. We don't burn out of it, okay? And grief is one of the more indelible imprints that emotions have on us. And we have to let it burn out of us. That is, you lose a loved one. And to say, oh, this is just emotion, just thought, just, you know, get back to the body and don't do that. Let this process burn out, which means memory work, which means the pain of being separated from your loved one, if that's the case. And that takes time. And so this is not, there are aspects of ourselves that require the time needed, and aspects of ourselves that we can immediately release because we see that it's not needed anymore. Not to confuse those, and not to get impatient with either one.
I appreciate your comment, but I guess what I'm asking is, in a dreaming state, is there a way to activate the foundation?
Yes, yes, okay, but you don't want to do it to, okay, so these things are always qualified, right? Because we do it for different motivations. Some of us do it to get rid of the grief. Let me just see it as, you know, okay, here's the body, here's, you know, it is a way because the grief is too hard to bear. So you don't want to do it from that motivation. You do it from curiosity. Like, okay, so I'm grieving. Is there more to my life in this moment than the grief I feel? And suddenly a space opens, you see. And you can feel the space, you can feel the formless that holds the form of grief. You're not trying to get rid of the grief then, you're just opening it beyond its limitation, beyond its boundary of being the only thing in your life, you see. And as you get more astute at being able to access the formless within form, the forms last much, they don't last as long. And you don't buy into, this is the important, you don't buy into the narrative that perpetuates the form. Oh, I can never have another, my life will always be, all that stuff isn't true. Your life will not always, how would you possibly know your life is always be, will always be, you see? So you start letting go of the insanity that invests in its narrative that perpetuates the grief. And that you do not to get rid of the grief because it's insane. It's not true. My life will never be the same. I'll never meet anybody else. All of that, it's like, what? How do I know that? I don't know that. Shut up. You don't know that. Right? Okay, so but for a while, those thoughts take front and center. And then with wisdom, they become thinner and less convincing. And then grief, it still has its time when all of you have lost somebody endearing, for this moment right now, think of that person. Don't you feel grief? You see? It never leaves you. But over time, it thins. It thins. And your life is likely just fine, even though that person isn't around anymore. Your life wasn't dependent upon that person for its existence. And what we're looking at is something far more important than the reliance upon something. We're looking for that which is existing, that has no reliance, that has no dependency. So grieving is a way to get back. If you if we interfere with the grief process, we will be reasserting form. If you let the grief process pass through you, then it'll just be gone. It'll be just surrendered. And there'll be nothing in your way.
Well, how do you let the grief...
Hi, Ramalee. Go ahead. How do I let the grief...
How do you let the grief be and not get swept away? I mean, I understand you're saying come back to the body, and it's easy now, but in the moment... And
okay, so, right. So if you let the grief be a part of the accompanying bodily experience, so anytime you're in your body, you're less in your mind. Okay, and so the grief is, like any emotion, it can become a totally cognitive affair where the thoughts are so unbearable. That's because you've lost touch with the body. But if you come back into the body and know the body is, then grief will have a quieter, it'll still move, and you'll still believe in them, the thoughts, but the thoughts won't take prerequisite over the body and your attention to it. And when your attention's divided between body and letting the mind do whatever its thing, it's not going to have the same impact. The mind isn't going to have the same impact as if you're 100% in there believing every thought you're, see? It gives you a perspective, a broader perspective when you're in your body. Stay in the body, the first foundation is really a call to really own ourselves within the body. Because when you're in the body, you're closer to now than when you're in the mind, believing the thoughts. And the closer you come to now, the less you'll suffer.
And that's the ultimate goal, right? And you've said this many times, but
wait a minute, what's the ultimate goal?
The end of suffering.
Okay, the end, I'm framing it as formless, the formless. Okay, so it's getting you closer to where existence is, but it's not there yet. It's like, here's existence, right? And we're in the body and in the mind, and we're kind of like going like this, right? So there's still more work to do, but it's less suffering than if it's just like this, you know, right? There's the more the mind is in free play, the more you're going to suffer, because it'll come up with anything. It'll make you delighted and it'll make you miserable, and you don't have any choice. Right? But if you have the body, it doesn't go that far out, because the body keeps calling it back to its base camp, you see? And so that keeps you from suffering as much.
So to know that I'm not in avoidance, I'm always wondering where that bottom line is, where is avoidance and where is...
Feel it from the body. You can feel resistance as a boundary. And as you tune yourself more and more into boundary formation, because you've learned that relaxation is much closer to the truth than tension. Do you see that? So as you allow yourself to be more relaxed and therefore less tense, you'll get a sense of when there is tension in the body with a more sensitive, you'll be more sensitive to when that occurs. And so as it occurs, sometimes it'll take you 5 or 10 minutes to say, oh my God, whatever, you know, and then you come back and it's like a pendulum. But you'll be able to start picking it up quicker as well when you're resisting. If there's a sensation associated with resistance as well as a thought, I don't want it. The thought usually is so quick, but the resistance is felt bodily to it. Okay? And as you start getting more and more comfortable with the boundary formations you already have and start seeing that tension, and then just releasing it, then when that tension comes back, you feel it. You see? That's actually like the fourth foundation is using your perceptive boundary formation to come back into the formless. I'll get to that tomorrow. So start practicing feeling your body tense and relaxed, just the difference between that. Now, not just not relatively, but deeply relaxed. Mentally, psychically relaxed. So the psychic quality and physical quality of relaxation. And you'll notice that as you psychically begin to relax, the thing expands. There's more space. It's amazing. Like right now, just psychically relax. And you avoid, all of a sudden you come into space. Now, anytime you're going into more space, you're headed in the right direction. Anytime you come into more relaxation, you're headed in the right direction. Because the other, the opposite, is suffering. The opposite is form. Form forms itself through contraction, right? By making it something, by claiming it to be something. That's contract. When this can only be a glass, there's a contraction that says it can be nothing else in me. And that's actually a body sensation. Oh, you know, it's like, okay. Now I can drink it, it doesn't matter. So it does require, it encourages you towards greater sensitivity of body and mind. That's the, in greater sensitivity begins to open up areas where we still are bleeding, really.
Would you say that all emotions then, like you just talked about grief, that you could put any emotions there and allow it to dissolve, like you just talked about with grief, they all, anger, fear, sadness?
Yes and no. Yes, in that all emotions come and go and can be, you know, seen in that way. But there are also some emotions that perpetuate themselves at very subtle levels because of self-assumptions. Like if somebody's doing something to you that you perceive as not recognizing your own individuality or dignity, there may be an assumption there that you're being abused when you're not. And that assumption could have an earlier childhood experience associated with it that makes you ferociously angry at this person next to you because they're not giving you the dignity that you felt they deserve. But that, it's fighting the assumption of your youth. It's fighting a self-assumption. And unless that self-assumption is exposed, you're going to be angry every time that situation occurs, no matter what you do in the moment to placate it. Do you see? It's, you got to go deeper. This thing requires, you know, we got to get right up to the black hole here. Like, whoa. All right. Yes, sir.
I've been doing it a lot of anxiety too. And I heard about a woman in South Seattle that does hypnosis and can take it away in this one session. She's like $150.
It's cheaper here. You know, each of us have our own inward direction and resonance, and there are, you know, we find ourselves in situations and with people that the circumstances of our lives brought us to this, and if it continues to feel like you're growing and moving in ways that are very productive to your life, then oftentimes that's a valuable relationship to have. If it feels like you're getting ripped off, you know, that, you know, why am I being charged? You know, if it starts to have that kind of controversy, it's better to move on. The first meditation practice I ever did was with some guy who, I was in my 20s, mid-20s, and he said, okay, I want you to think of the thing you like the best and dwell upon it, and you'll watch it create, you'll see that it starts creating itself in the material world. So he gave that instruction, and I knew nothing about anything spiritual, and I said, this is a bunch of crap. If all I'm doing is replicating my life in better forms, I know there was something in me that said, I'm out of here. So there was a clear dissonance there. And I never went back. And then when I got into a tradition that, like this one, which made sense to me even from the very beginning, I just hung in there. It gets difficult no matter what you do, but it always, that sense of resonance remains when you're on track. Okay, so use that as your guidance. And no one can tell you whether that works for you, but it doesn't work for me, you know. It's each of it is an individual's response to it. Now, yeah, well, you were in need of some blocks, right? Because you're a very tall man. So if you have an extra one of those gray blocks that you can give this man, just raise your hand there so people can see who you are. Yeah, he needs the big ones. Good, okay. Yes, sir. Yes.
Why is this day different from all other days?
Are you asking that philosophically or? You're joking. Okay, but in some, okay, listen to this. I have a cosmological example. Okay, this is really cool. I love these things. Okay, so a photon is a particle or wave of light, right? Moving at some astronomically speed of 186,000 miles a second. And all the photons were created in the Big Bang. Okay. That was 13.8 billion years ago, all right? So a photon that reaches your eye now had its origins in the Big Bang 13.8 billion years ago, okay? So keep that in mind. Now, the faster something goes, the slower time is in relationship to that thing. You come to the speed of light and there's no time at all. It's dead stop. Photons, light itself, is traveling at the speed of light, so it's dead stop. So the photon that's entering your eye now and the photon that it was emitted at the Big Bang 13.8 billion years ago has never moved. Is exactly the same photon, and it's never moved. So this moment, from the photon's perspective, is the Big Bang occurring. That is Dharma. Because what we're doing, everything else is artificial. Everything else is relative. All the times that we, 13.8, that's a thought. The photon is the only thing I know in nature that knows that's a thought and doesn't move. And it's light itself. Don't you love that? So we're going back to the essence of things, you see? Back to where the Big Bang actually occurred, to where life, to where nothing has actually occurred, ever. And at the same time move with the photons coming into your eye. And there's no difference between those two perspectives. Okay, so that's enough. So last May, Narayan and I taught at the Forest Refuge. Many people who attended who were here in the room, and we framed the entire month like I'm framing today, this weekend. You know, it's not easily accessible Dharma, but it stretches people. And what we both found was that although we were framing it like that, the interviews, for the most part, had to deal with the pain that was going on in the individual, not so much the searching or the inquisition of where we were directing people. It was the kind of the condensed version of what was coming out of your life and your life history. And we realized that, you know, that this thing can be obstructed so easily. That form, when that's what we have led and spent our life believing in, really takes precedent over any searching or any any ulterior, higher motive. And that really has to be cleaned up in order to move on. It's almost like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, that the pain, the range of pain within us really has to be understood sufficiently so that this energy can move towards higher elevation, towards a higher sense of embrace. Because when we start out, most of us are very, very confused about what form and formlessness are. We really don't know where the sacred lies. And we look for it in all sorts of things. Mostly we create pictures of people who we think are sacred, and then, or statues, like the Buddha or Jesus, and then we bow and revere those statues. And that brings us as close to the sacred as we think we can be, and maybe we'll go to church or something, but outside of rare moments, maybe when we're outside taking a walk, we feel something different, something spacious. We don't know how to access it regularly. We don't know what obstructed it so that we can no longer access it. And we feel tied up in tension with ourselves in the pain that our lives hold. And that's the spiritual predicament. There's a lot of work we have to do at the very fundamental level, which is where most Dharma students spend their time, in this, on the level of learning how to see their minds from a different perspective and develop loving kindness to offset the angst and attitude that we have going into ourselves and all of that, you know. So that's not wasted time. So I don't want to in any way make you think that, you know, what I'm talking about today is sort of a better Dharma. It's just, as you have cleared up some of this, then there's a natural movement of that energy towards deeper inclusiveness, deeper reach of embrace. And some of you have stayed back with the more basic teachings because you weren't given an option. You've never been told that there's a way to move forward in this. And so that's really what this book is written about. And may I say, I'll be happy to sign any book that you would like, any of the books I wrote that you would like. I'm just waiting for the day somebody brings me a dictionary to sign. So I'd be happy to. And in fact, tomorrow, if you'll wait, that we'll have a signing at the end at 4 o'clock. But if you're not going to be here tomorrow at 4, which I hope all of you are, but if you're not, then you can bring it up to me at odd times, like a walking period. I'd be happy to do it. Always include your name, because believe me, I probably have seen you 100 times, but doesn't necessarily mean that I've recognized your name. So just bring your name on a little slip of paper so that I don't have that awkwardness. So separating form from form, we have to know what each of these things are. We have to separate them out, and we're artificially separating them out. But they're so enmeshed in the beginning that all we see is form. And you know, if I can just, you know, the awareness is what's looking out of your eyes. That's how close it is. But it's not what the eye sees. What the eye sees is form. And because we're used to only looking at the expressions, the experiences of the awareness that awareness holds, we skip the awareness. That's, what good's that? Let me go to, you know, the chocolate or whatever it is, you see? So it's not obstructed in any way. It's just that our intentionality for life is to get as much out of the forms that we see as possible. Do people understand that? Because it's very important to understand what the basic problem is. Basic problem is not that the spiritual is somewhere else, it's just that we're not interested in it. We're bypassing that to feed our lives through the formations that we've always lived with. And we try to gather them or consume them or do something with them to try to bring them in closer. But it doesn't work. And so there's two ways that it doesn't work anyway, but you can make it not work quicker. if you begin to recognize that forms are in various expressions of decay. It's kind of like eating a dead fish, except it's rotting. And so forms, you know, they aren't as appealing as your mind would play upon them and think they were. So the one thing is to start noticing that what I wanted out of this isn't what I'm getting, and there's a disappointment, and it's not your fault. It's the fact that form itself doesn't hold what you thought it did. There's a great quote from Winnie the Pooh in that book, and it says, Igor, one of those creatures, said, what he liked most of all things is honey. But he said, well, no, wait a minute. There's a moment before I get the honey that's even better than the honey. That's what we are, see, that's where we are. So one of the things, start working, looking at form and seeing that it's not offering you what it is. But we usually blame ourselves for it not being as good as we thought it was going to. I didn't buy the best one. I don't live in the biggest house. All of that. You just look at it. It's never going to be rewarding. It doesn't matter what house you live in or what food you eat. Okay, so that's an important. The other important thing is that you begin, as this dawns on you, you get disenchanted with life. As we center our way out of confusion, two things happen. The world is less frightening because we see that we're the creator of our own fear. And the more we solidify our existence within the body, the less we run away when fear arises. And also it's less enticing. Forms are just less enticing than they used to be. And people think, oh God, you know, is life losing its enticement? Well, it is. And that's wisdom. That's not, you're not doing something wrong. That's what it looks like when you see it from wise eyes. And so there's a general pullback in energy from racing after the expressions of form, both because they're decaying and impermanent in all of that area, which the Buddha fully explores, but also because it doesn't mean as much. I know that they're not going to give, but the payoff isn't going to be as great as I thought it was. And you can be working on that edge too, to say, oh, you know, this cake looks so good, and then I ate it, and it was like, huh? And it's all the better. That's all it is. That's as good as it gets. So that's an important expression of form. But there's another way that we have to work this thing for us to understand form. See, we've pulled it apart now. Form and the formless. Okay? Now I can say formless is, you know, what the seeing out of your eyes, the seeing itself is the formless. And you go, all I see are objects. Well, that's because that's what we've trained to look at. But there's a way that you can, once you become disenchanted and you pull psychically back from infusing your energy into form, that the formless becomes very obvious. It's the medium out of which everything is held, within which everything is held. And so then you go, oh, I see, it's beginning to dawn on me now. And that's, then you got to really get a sense of how we keep confiscating, how we keep inserting ourselves in form, in the formless, excuse me. We keep asserting, there's the formless, the seeing, but we keep claiming we're the one that sees. We keep claiming ownership of the seeing itself. That's what mindfulness is. You're being aware, that's mindfulness, that's the formless, the awareness is formless. But then there's I, where did that come from? I am being aware of this. So now there's three things, right? There's me, the awareness, and the object that I'm seeing. And there's no division at all in any of that. So we got to get it back down to one, right? So what's happening there? Well, what's happening there is that as we become quieter, we see that the I, who's claiming ownership and directing one's attention and mindfulness, is really the mind as form being confused. It's not being seen as thought, as an image, as the sense of oneself. And that's being confused with the mindfulness, which is pure, that's paying attention to whatever object it's paying attention to. So I say, okay, so I've got to clean up my mindfulness. I've got to take me out of it. Because as long as I'm in it, it's dualistic. It's not working. I'm not seeing purely what the formless is. Again, you see, we're taking this thing out. We're artificially separating these things, and that's where the third and fourth foundation come in. He brings them back together. But for now, it's very important to separate these things out so that we know where the sacred lies. It doesn't lie in a statue. In fact, it's said that when someone awakens to the truth, even in a flash, the first thing that drops away is the belief in rites and rituals and statues and bowing and all of that, because that never got you closer to anything. You see, immediately you see that's form. Form's not going to ever cross the bridge to formless. And I always thought if I prayed enough and did all that would work. No, it doesn't. It doesn't work. There's no way to cross the bridge from form to formless, except I have to take this off for a second. Okay, so we're getting to see the basic. Okay, so then you go, everywhere I turn, I am there. I'm the one that's looking. I can't see the formless because I'm directing the formless with my attention. I'm just in the way all the time, and I don't know what to do about it. And it just seems, I don't know what to do about it. So let me just explore when I come into the picture and when I'm less apparent. So we just take on something like that. Now I have to go back to my astronomy here. There's a tension, a balance called hydrostatic equilibrium. In a sun, in suns, S-U-N, there's gravity. It's an immensely mass. It's an immense mass. So there's a lot of gravity. And the only thing that balances that gravity is the driving fuel inside the fusion that has outward pressure. So the balance between that inward pressure of the gravity and the outward pressure of the fusion and the heat keeps the sun at a certain shape and size, a certain diameter. All right. So spiritually, the equivalence of that is the egoic dynamic. There's an equilibrium in our egoic dynamic. So what does that mean? That means that if we ever completely relaxed and had no force of gravity whatsoever keeping us, we'd blow apart. We would just like that. You wouldn't recognize yourself. You'd blow apart. You wouldn't blow apart in some kind of scary way. You would just be. You would be everything instead of yourself. That's what I mean by blowing apart. Not that you would have some kind of explosion, okay? Okay, so you're a supernova. So that, what is the pressure that keeps us contained, that keeps that heart from just going on? Well, it's tension. We mentioned it today. It's the wanting. It's wanting. We have to want continuously. And the wanting is the expression that condenses it down so that you look to yourself the way you appear. You're the size of yourself. And sometimes that wanting gets out of control and exceeds the equilibrium, and it looks like a huge egoic reaction. And sometimes the wanting is very in abeyance and very quiet, and it looks very spacious and very wondrous and very, very contented. It looks very content. But to start noticing that equilibrium, that way that we keep ourselves contained. And I mentioned like relaxation is one beautiful guide that starts showing us ourselves in relationship to relaxation, and we can fine tune that so we can really get a sense and a deepening sense of when we're tight or in contraction. Contraction forms us. So you say contraction forms us, what does that mean? Well, I'll explain that, and that's where feelings come in. Okay, now feelings, in the traditional Buddhist language, feelings are tones, feeling tones of pleasant or unpleasantness, or not unpleasant or unpleasant. So you have something you like in your mouth, and there's a feeling tone of pleasantness, not the taste of that, but the pleasantness of that taste. Or something noxious in your mouth, it's not the taste, it's the feeling of aversion, or it's not even aversion, it's just ugh, right? Or something is not attractive or repulsive, there can be a tone of just neutrality where you're not drawn into it or away, but it's not holding your attention, and soon that neutrality turns into boredom. Okay, and then boredom turns into a noxious experience at some point. So you can see that feelings don't stay steady. They turn and evolve. Now here's the important point of feeling. We think, and this is huge, okay, we think that the feeling is coming from the object, that it holds that expression, and we taste the feel, we taste it, and the feeling is unlocked from that chocolate or whatever it is. It doesn't. It comes from our mind's projection onto that something. We hold the feeling and give it to that something, so that when chocolate comes in the mouth, this is important, the memory of that chocolate, often associated with pleasantness from the past, brings forth that feeling from our minds, and it's then reproduced upon that taste. So the pleasantness is not something that's contained in the object. It's something that we project onto the object. This is important because the whole of the explosion of self comes from the seeds of that feeling tone. And if it came from the outside, then we would be an autonomous object outside. But since it comes from the inside, it's all a projection elaborated on by this feeling. So the sense of I is not something independent. It's a chain link of contingencies based upon how we appreciate or don't something in our immediate surround. It's very interesting how this works. And when you get... You say, okay, I don't know if that's true, Rodney. You say that, but I don't know if that's true. Let me see. Then you start, okay, I just want to notice feelings. Pleasant or unpleasant or neutral? And what happens to my mind within each one? What happens in sequence when I taste something pleasant? Well, I want it. I mean, you can just feel, well, I want more of that. There's a leap there. But in that leap, there's a whole chain of events that occur that embellish that feeling to a high pitch. So feeling's just a feeling, but then the next thing that happens is you're desiring that feeling. There's a, I want more of that. Now here you go, see? This is now no longer the present moment is not relevant now. When we desire something, we have a feeling tone that is being manifested from the present. As a past feeling, it's coming into the present from a past expression or past memory of a feeling. And then the desire that I want more of this, there's more isn't there, it's what the mind creates. I want more of that in the future. So the past, which is associated to the feeling, and the future, which is wanting to embellish that feeling for longer durations, is all mixed up in that. And that comes out as a ferocious desire, craving, clinging. And on it goes. And from this clinging craving comes becoming, me, I come in. I don't come, there's no I that comes in. The I that comes in is the embellishment of all these things. And in the book, I talk about it as a group of guests at a dinner table, and they're being denied dinner, and so they're beating on the table, and the feeling tone, you know, ignorance is sitting at the front of the table, and all the guests, which are the dependent origination, are sitting around the table, and they're all clamoring for the food. And the overtone of all that clamoring, you know what an overtone is, right? It's not on in the table, it's not a, it doesn't have a seat at the table, it's something that comes out of the sounds of all that clamoring, is I. The I comes from feeling, desire, becoming, etc., etc. And then all of a sudden, I want. Where did the I want? There was feeling, there was the thought of time and desire of future, I want this more of this. There's also the past, because I only remember it because of the memory of having associated with chocolate in the past, and the projection of feeling onto that thing. See, the whole thing just gets like that, and then all of a sudden we claim ownership of I. Now, where you see, it's crazy, and you can see this. This is observable. But we break it apart. We make it very, we break it in bite-sized parts. And you just take areas of yourself where, you know, you feel yourself embellishing the experience to such a promoted way that you're in demand. That, you know, not, I'm not going, you know, where it's totally insulated and you're the only one in the picture and you aren't listening to anyone, because an insulated person doesn't listen to anyone. And you got to have what you want and all of that, okay? If there can just be a little space in there, a little smile of, wow, this is amazing. And each of us have those moments when we cut off on the road, you know, and go, God, damn, ugh. I'm glad there's nobody else in the Dharma in the car. So just start watching the waxing and waning of your own image. Just notice it. You're not doing it. It's being done to you. Okay, there's no you to do it. It's being drawn out of you. Okay? It just, when the right circumstances arise, so will you. And so when you get, when you've lived through a number of those different situations, and then you're quiet, you get quiet to the whole self-formation. Now, we can go back into looking at the dynamics that are within mindfulness. Okay, so now I want something, I'm directing my attention, which is a wanting. Why would you direct your attention? You're directing your attention, and then there's a me. And the moment I direct my attention is mine. And I'm directing my attention towards whatever it is, the breath, or whatever it might be. And so the three things, me, my attention, and the object of my attention, they're all getting confused. But with proper orientation, you say, okay, so the sense of me is arising because I'm moving my attention with volition, a volitional intention. There's nothing wrong with that. You just need to see that there's no you behind there that's directing the flashlight. It's just circumstances. It's just conditioning that has allowed us to do that. And when you do that, then you start picking up the hydrostatic equilibrium and the tension that is needed in order for you to continue to believe in yourself. And we actively see, I mean, look at our leadership, and you'll see that there's an active need for drama in order for him to self-validate. He can't not be dramatic. There's no way. Drama is too much of a self-indicator for him. That's how he knows where he is by rubs, by the rubs of life. And he gets his fulfillment from that rub. Okay, so all of us, I'm not picking on him actually, because all of us are in some ways the same. We all have a equilibrium in which we're comfortable. Some of you, it's a very quiet equilibrium. You love to be quiet, you love to sit, follow your breath. You want your life to be simple and smooth, and that's fine, it's beautiful. But there's still you, and there's still a belief in you. It's an easier place to observe what's actually going on than if you're a drama queen or king, because there's too much, you know, fraught and fight that's in angst. But as we get quieter, those are the right seeds for us to begin to continue to question our way through this. And that's what the feeling tone does. It allows us, it gives us a path for us to understand the formation of me. Now listen, okay? The formation of me parallels the formation of the world, right? I am desiring something. I am fearing something. The something I am fearing and the I that fears it arise together from all of these contingencies. So the duality that we see, the you that I want or fear, and the me that's fearing and wanting, are arising together, projected from the mind. It's mind projection. And you can see this. You can actually bear witness to the sense of you and the object arising at the same time. And just as an example, and you can have your own examples, but I was on a elliptical machine and, you know, I was paying attention. And there was there wasn't any world, there wasn't any me. Now, I wasn't aware there wasn't any world, but I suddenly realized I didn't like doing what I was doing, exercising, it was hard. A moment I had that aversive feeling, the world and the exercising and the me all came back together. Now you say, where was I? Well, it's not, you're nowhere. You don't go somewhere and hide and come back. You're just not. It's awareness. What's left after you leave is the formless. That's what's left. Okay, so you see this is incredible, because now, I mean, the body was wonderful because you begin to see that it's also self-formed by our knowledge and remembrance, and we keep imparting and infusing knee and elbow and jaw and teeth and all of that to make it into it. And if we just be quiet, it sort of loses its boundaries. That's great. But this next step of feeling takes us much deeper into how the world and ourselves are created in this moment. This does not have to be done, please believe me on this, in some kind of hibernated way, months and months of sitting. You may choose that path. That's fine if you do. What it does require is your intentionality and spirit, excitement really, like I in an astronomy class where you're learning some. It takes you have to show up for this thing and want to know that. The reason we don't is because who wants to know that the nothing of the world? It sounds like a dead end. But you know what? It's the beginning. It's the beginning. It's the beginning of the world. It's the beginning of everything. And what you leave behind is ignorance. This is confusion. Do you want to stay dreaming? Do you want to stay in a dream? Just say, okay, I'll just continue to dream. I just don't want to put the energy to wake up. But there is, but there's a, the possibility is there and the freedom in that. I wouldn't send you in that direction if it was, if you were going to be consumed by some black hole. Black hole is not, it's friendly. It's inviting. You can't talk about it without it coming. And you see? Oh, you see? Formless. It doesn't, you do, all you have to do is turn your attention. Say, ah. Oh. It's not out there. It's not the end of your breath. It's just being invited in. Oh. And many of you have had that experience where you're, where, but I don't either, it's scary. I don't know, you go off and you start practicing the way you practiced that led to the burying of that experience. Doing the very things that are antagonistic to the encouragement of it. And why is that? Because of the pain. Once we release the boundaries of self, the pain that was the boundaries were keeping at bay, because there's tension, that tension is kept partially to keep the pain of crossing that boundary. And when you cross the boundary, you open the whole thing up to all the pain, you see? So you go, oh, I don't want, oh, I relaxed too much there, I've got to get back to some tension here. I mean, can you imagine what our leadership's mind would look like if he relaxed? He would be blown out of the water. There's so much pain in there. And you, like you think, okay, this guy's operating from ignorance. But it's so closed. I think he actually believes what he says. And that's amazing that anybody could believe what he said. But that's how clamped down this thing is, you see. That's how, let it be a warning of how if we keep going in the opposite direction, how clamped down we can become. Where it's all false truth, you know, it's all false truth. Made up. Wow. I mean, if that thing explodes, it will be a supernova. I just don't want to go along with it. And that could be a lot of drama, couldn't it? To keep him very safely in himself, the more drama he creates. And look what's within finger reach of him. That's so scary. I mean, oh, anyway. So this, the first thing is to start seeing how we project feelings on. You know, we're the mind is creating all this. It's so interesting. There's nothing to the mind. The mind's black. There's no light coming into the mind. It's just black inside there. It's in a shell called the skull. Okay. It has some photons of light coming in through its retina, hitting some neurons that signal a certain pattern to this thing that's in the dark. Meanwhile, some variable sound waves are coming in through the ear, which it's assimilating to be what an expectation or memory it has heard before. This thing is totally in the dark. And it's getting their neurological input from a lot of different arenas. And it thinks now that the picture it has created from its memory, from its conditioning, is the true and accurate depiction of the world. Now there's something wrong there. And that's what we're living in, most of us. The only information that comes in there are little billions of electrical hits that somehow it's able to organize into this. It never sees a thing. It never hears a thing. All it gets is these electrical impulses. That's scary. Okay, so I don't want to live, cocooned in that. And so you start feeling the effects of what it means to live within that cocoon. You start feeling the isolation and loneliness of what most people hold. We don't even know what it means to be connected because we don't know how to get outside of our minds to connect. Because we live within the fabrication of our own making. The world is self-fabricated. I am self-fabricated along with it. And from that dualistic split that the mind itself has created, I try to grow out of that into something I call enlightened or awakening. That can't be done. How can ignorance be the governance? How can ignorance drive this car? But awareness, that which sees the experience, the sacred or formless, that is not mind created. That's outside of the mind. And anyone who has experienced awareness will immediately sense that this thing, the boundaries of it are not contained. In fact, if the boundaries were contained in the mind, it would be part of the mind that you couldn't see because it would always be looking at. But this can see the entire mind, which proves that it holds the mind, but itself is not contained within it. And that's what we're trying to free here. But the freedom of that is not what the mind is telling you you see. What the mind tells you you see and what you are, the person who sees, that's fiction. That's just the neurological systems building up its own conclusion. But the seeing itself, that's the freedom. What is looking out of your eyes in this moment? What is seeing out of your eyes? Not what are you seeing. You see, and you do practices that confuse all that. It's like knowing now the array of the universe. It's not confusing. Once you've got to know the direction this thing takes, or you get caught in practices that just reinforce the ignorance. And you think you're really doing something, you know, whatever it is and all the whatever. But it's just a cat chasing its own tail. Oftentimes, there's enough wisdom in you that just hearing it you can have a moment grasp of it. You can sense it. Just hearing it. Because you're willing to be quiet enough in that moment to move outside the noise that keeps us contained within the confusion. In Tibetan, it's called the pointing out instruction, where a person is led to the stillness that is the revelation. And you go, oh wow. And you know it because it's bone marrow deep. And it isn't stillness as a, like my mind's quiet, I'm not thinking. It's stillness that goes cellular. Okay. So one of the teachings today that I would encourage you to engage in is to feel that dynamic hydrostatic equilibrium within ourselves, that sense of needing some tension in order to be known, and how each of us decide what degree of that tension is necessary and how much we want to be known, talking about egoically. So there's a great deal of pressure. You can feel the boundaries when somebody is under a great deal of his own contraction. You can feel it in the person. And oftentimes, immediately in speech, there is a need to divide and to resist and to obstruct. You can feel it. And that's where many of the unwholesome qualities come from, is where they all come from there, from that inward tension, that, right? And then as we become really more self-confident, but not self-confident in the sense of self-confident, but existent, confident existence, that we know our place and we feel relaxed within that place, there's a releasing of the tension, of much of the tensions, that the psychic tensions that we've lived with. We don't need to prove ourselves. If somebody questions us, the first dynamic is not a defense. They can misunderstand us without us having to rattle off how good we are. And you can just feel the inward ease of that. And at the same time, that inward ease replicates a spiritual unfolding of more space, lighter lightness of being. And then you know you're living the journey rather than practicing the journey, which can have its own contraction. You haven't done enough, right? If you're going this way, you're going the wrong way. And so to develop a sensing of that dynamic. And as we release more and more, the space gets wider and wider. And to the point, and also what you do internally in meditation, it becomes very different. You learn to leave things alone. You don't have to quarrel with every experience. Because what's an experience? Ask what you're quarreling about. A memory? Well, that's good. A feeling? You see, it all gets nothingness. We turn it back in. We just keep folding it back in on itself, and it doesn't sustain itself. It takes our contraction to sustain it. I'm trying to give some instruction on how to carry this out. The exercises can be very simple, yet very revelatory. They don't require, the concentrated focus that this tradition is most known for. That, if you think of what concentration is, it's an inward experience. And therefore, by definition, there must be an outward experience in contrast to that. Now we've got two. And it feels so good, feeling, that I want to do more and more contraction. And it shows me microscopically what's occurring, which is a very pleasant feeling. It gives you a sense of mastery. But so does a microscope. But that's not really what, you see, this is me. Well, it's no different than a microscope. It's all here at this level of introspection. It doesn't have to be, we don't have to go undertake years of turmoil and focus, and it doesn't have to be like that. It just has to be questions. We just have to ask pertinent questions for ourselves and not be sidetracked by our fears. And then it all opens up. It just does. How can it not? You know, there's nothing protecting it from us except our fear. And so once we are willing to go through that, it all opens up. And the contraction loosens and the whole thing widens up. Because there's nothing protecting us. There's nothing, there's no Mara or devil who's going to keep us packaged in. It's not going to happen. Well, you have to ask yourself, well, do we want to open up? That's probably, but do you want to die contracted? Anyway, so questions from you, comments. Yes, sir.
I understand how the sense of self can be created from a pleasant feeling come or an unpleasant feeling come. How is it created from a neutral feeling come?
Well, because it doesn't stay neutral. A neutral tone is you're not paying attention at all, so you're lost in thought, basically. That's one way a neutral tone can go, because there's nothing there that fascinates you enough to keep you there. The other thing that a neutral tone quickly becomes is an unpleasant boredom. And now it's not neutral anymore. Now it's boring, right? And what we're doing in boredom is waiting for this moment to move into something more interesting. So we're, again, just wading through something. So that's in a kind of an aversive sense. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to look at a white wall and see how long it remains neutral. Because there's nothing there, right? It's like, I'm tired of doing this. Yeah, and it becomes unpleasant. In fact, changing, these are conditioned. This is a conditioned investment. So what's pleasant in one moment? Eat chocolate until you're sick of it and you've gone from pleasant to unpleasant. You know, anything can change like that. So those tones come and go in different circumstances. The point is that we do it to the chocolate. The chocolate didn't give us pleasant or it would never change to unpleasant, would it? We have to be sick of the chocolate in order to invest unpleasant into it. But who's sick of it? The chocolate's not sick of me. You see, it's so obvious, really, when you start looking at the thing. So then now I can own my own seed of origin, because that's really what the Buddha is saying here. He said, and then from around that seed of origin, I know most of you who have lived with my teaching for even a few months knows this analogy, but I'm going to use it anyway. So you have a supersaturated sugar solution, and you put a string in it, right? And the supersaturated solution is very hot, and you let it cool down. That's a feeling tone. And as the water cools down, it forms rock candy around the string. And that's what feelings, as they become elaborated on, start getting built up into something besides just a string. They become rock, hard, and defined, and characterized by emotions. And the whole sense of self floods around it and builds from it. And it's the inception of that. That's the inception. And once you have that, then you have your whole logical history and why you're so this and that of a person and the conclusions you formed over the years. And so, you know, and it's just a thread. It's like, let's back this thing up and see where all this came from.
So that string would never be a neutral feeling. That string would never be a neutral feeling.
Well, you put a neutral feeling tone in and see what what starts gathering around it, first you have to pay attention to it, and that's hard enough. If you're not paying attention to it, it's already got a whole, this is awful, I'm, that's the rock candy, right? So really what I'm talking about is that you're no longer focused on the feeling, you're focused on the story and narrative around the feeling, because that's what spins itself out. And then when it's, and then it just keeps spinning, because it keeps bringing more of you in. It's no longer about whatever it is that you were initially attracted to, it's about your whole relationship with that and other things and how come you were deprived of that and your history. And now you've got years of psychoanalysis to go through. You know, it's very interesting to me just to watch myself come in and as a full embodied person around nothing. Somebody says something, you know, it's like, you know, they get a whole frontal attack. You know, that poor person was—they didn't even know what they're doing because they aren't—they don't know what feeling tone I have related to what they're saying. You know, and so it's just very interesting. But see, this is building up because we're going to go to the third and fourth foundation. I hope people come because this actually deepens tomorrow. And the third and fourth, I mean, he just takes us right through. I always thought, I never knew what does feeling, body feel, I don't, like they never fit together. They're just ways to practice mindfulness. But it doesn't mean anything. Why? It could be anything. You could practice mindfulness on anything. So what are these four things, you know, that was never explained to me and I've never read. How that was a continuum until I started giving talks to this group. And then of course, this is a continuum. He's showing us how form was created, how we can dissolve form, and then the next two foundations are what, when we're right at the moment of creation, form and forms, what happens in the mind for that process for one of the other of those to transpire, form or formlessness. And then he takes us to the last foundation, which is how to hold formlessness. I'm saying this completely wrong, but how formlessness sustains itself even as the intrusion of I still gathers momentum in some way. And you use his teaching, the four foundations, you just remind yourself. I mean, he probably said this very simply, but suddenly it got all laden with, well, what five characteristics are happening now? And is this all the intervening years have piled stuff on top of this very, very simple teaching, which is how to sustain. See, again, you don't sustain the formless. But you can't really talk about it. So what you do is, but you find yourself going back into form, and then there's a release, and you're back into the formless, and back into form. So that dynamic there is the fourth foundation, which is very interesting. Jerry?
What feeling tones arise?
A what?
When there's a full awakening.
No feeling tone.
So all that conditioning
is gone, yeah.
That would be significantly different than
you. Yes, yes. Yeah, everything, it's not neutral. It's alive. It's not, you know, even to call it something is, what is aliveness? There's no feeling tone in aliveness. There's aliveness in aliveness. There's no components to aliveness. And so that's the escape, you might say. Yes?
Sure. So I'm curious, even the feeling of fear, which that survival, fight, survival fear is gone?
Primal fear?
The survival fear.
Survival fear.
Survival fear, yeah.
Yes. Yes, because survival fear is when you're trying to survive as a person, as a contraction. That's what a boundary is survival fear. It's if I cross this boundary, I'm not going to exist. And so I'm going to stay on this boundary and I'll protect myself from having to cross it, you see? And then all of a sudden you cross it because you let down your guard one day, and suddenly you don't know the difference between mind and body, and you feel the expanse and the freedom of that boundarylessness. And then you get afraid. You go, oh my God, what did I just do? And now, you see, that's how most of us go through this thing, is kind of two steps up, one step back, two steps back, one step, like that, kind of shifting. But the fear, you might think of fear is the trump card. No, but wrong word. as the card that's being played to get you back into contraction. It's the final mental response to your awakening.
And so that would include that when you're driving and a car comes in front of you, you might not be even scared.
Well, no, I mean, there are dynamics that continue to play out regardless, you know, in the body. You know, a car is coming at me, you know, it's like, ah! There's a body dynamic in that, you know, that plays itself out as far as I can see. Yes.
Thank you for, it's great having you here today. I hope I can explain ask this question, but when you were doing the healing meditation, I kept going back to an image in my mind of something that I really want in my life. So there was that desire and craving, and it's coming up a lot where it causes pain, it causes suffering, and it's connected to a deep wound. And I guess my question is, and I'm not quite sure I've articulated, how do I, the impetus, I know, okay, if I just move away from this and not add narrative, I'm okay. But there's what's the impetus? How can I almost acknowledge to myself, it's okay to not think about that without doing some kind of a bypass?
So you know, yeah, yes. I think you sort of answered it yourself, and that is, you know, there's a deep wound. And the deep wound has a self-assumption associated with it, like I can't be full or I can't be complete without something, unless I'm married, unless I'm something. And that assumption that I'm incomplete now is really the pain of the desire that needs to be fulfilled, that's being driven. The pain of not being complete is what's driving the desire to be complete, you see? And so to go to that pain, and the pain will show itself in many ways, not just in terms of that one object, because a sense of incompletion doesn't stick with just one object. Like, I need to be married in order to be complete. It's more basic than that. It's more the deep sense of incompletion is beyond just one object, service of one object. And so it'll come up in many different ways. And you can do one of two things, and that is you can go out and look for solutions in the world to try to balance out that feeling so that you'll feel complete. But you'll also find that if you find the thing that you think you will need to, you won't. The teeter-totter will stay down, you know, it won't ever come right back. It'll come back for a while, but then over time it sinks back down to a lower level of self-debasement. So you have to go into, there's only one way to heal, and that's to see. And seeing, the importance is in the word seeing, because it's not, seeing is not opinionating or judgment. The judgment keeps adding fuel to it. So the seeing itself doesn't. It's only seeing that doesn't. And so you clean up your seeing. You got to clean up your seeing. You can't, if you're back there with a judgment, that's more pain, probably the same pain, that's looking at the pain of why I'm feeling incomplete. I'm even incomplete in my seeing. You see, it's very tricky. Do you have a question? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, what do you mean when you say clean up your seeing?
I mean, take a broom and clean that sucker up. I mean, see what's in there that has you looking through something, through some image, through some idea, because that's obscuring the seeing that is healing. Seeing, okay, feels like what the light is doing with you right now. What? What's the light doing to me right now? It's highlighting me. That's all. It's revealing. That's all. It doesn't have any, it's not pressuring me. It's not opinionating. It's revealing. That's clean seeing. Okay, so when I'm looking, that's how clean my seeing needs to be. No, there's, I'm not saying, okay, so don't box yourself in so that you only have one. All of us have needs for other skillful means along the way here. And if you need therapeutic intervention or you need to try out and see if whatever it is that's missing in your life actually does, you know, all these ways of working with us is what life is about, really. But what you're going to find is that you won't clean up the mess completely until there's clear seeing. That's what you're going to find, but you have to prove that to yourself. So you try to substitute good things in your life and you still feel miserable, or you try to go to therapists and work it out so that you can, I don't know what you do, you know, I don't know. But in the end, there's only one way to heal, completely, completely heal. There's a ways to partially heal, lots of ways to partially heal. There's only one way to completely heal. That's through pure seeing. Most of us don't know what that means, you know, which is, and we don't know how to access it, you see. But all you have to do is access it, is to see what it is that's interfering with your pure seeing. You have to purify your seeing, your intention, so you want to see how you're getting in the way of yourself, a way of that clarity. You don't want to add, so that means no. See, it's, you don't want to judge. I mean, all these things, these the basic instructions when you first sat down here in day one, okay, we don't, non-judgmental awareness, all of it, is what you have to apply in its infinite degree, years, decades later in your practice. And hopefully all along the way you've developed a greater sensitivity to the ways you obstruct clear seeing so that you're more attuned to how to clean it up. Cleaning it up doesn't mean doing something about it. It means seeing what's there. So now the seeing, okay, so now you've got seeing and you've got me. Then you say, oh, I'm in the middle of this thing, so I'm going to see that. And now there's just seeing of that. But then you start, well, I'm doing a pretty good job. Now you've got to see that. You see, so you just keep going out. It's like the, you know, like there's that hand game. Right? I don't know what it is. Yes.
So the clear seeing does not necessarily imply that you need to understand the roots.
No. That doesn't. Okay, now wait a second. It's important because for many people, understanding the roots has a point, because it, you no longer blame yourself when you can see that it was your parents who created the conditions for this feeling to arise in you. Okay, so that helps satisfy the blame game, self-blame, by seeing that, which helps move you forward. But it doesn't, it's not clear, it's not, blaming in any way, pointing the fingers is not the solution to this ultimately. Does that make sense? Yeah. So, you know, therapy, I'm not in any way, yeah, it's it has a point, it has a purpose.
I'm talking about therapy so much as the mind play.
Yeah, that.
When you're looking at why.
No, leave it alone. Okay, leave it alone, except if you find, there are certain occasions when you can feel the pain being so deep and embedded within you that you need to focus in on that and feel, just hear the story of that trauma in yourself, right? So like it's like something's wrong with me. Okay, so something's wrong with me. Oh, something's wrong with me. And then you hear everybody telling you there's something wrong with you. You see, feel the memories of it. You feel the little kid that wants to wall off the world because there's something wrong with him. You feel being out of place. All those memories come springing back. But you're not adding anything new to them. You're not reconditioning their influence. You're just letting them out like you've opened up a can of worms. Why would worms fly out? Yeah, like whatever. Yeah, birds fly out. Bats. I like bats. Yes, sir.
So you have like a one way of sinning, or do everybody have to develop his own way of sinning?
You have to, my hearing isn't very good, so let me just get somebody to tell me what was said.
Does everyone develop their own way of seeing, or is there just one way of seeing?
There's just one seeing, and it's not yours. Okay, there's our seeing. I mean, this is my seeing, right? God, these glasses have been with me for 20 years. I really like, that's my way of seeing, because it has to do with my story and my narrative, right? So that's your seeing. Seeing, when it's free of the person, which is free of the person's story, is universal. It's everyone's. That's what oneness is. That's what formlessness is. Formlessness, everything is included in formlessness because it holds everything. It even holds your seeing. Okay, if it doesn't make sense to you, this is really important. Don't dismiss it. Say, what the hell is he talking about? No, use it as a tool for curiosity, because then you'll be drawn in. Remember, if you're not tense would be a rejection. I don't want that. That's ridiculous. That's tension. Then you're creating more tension. But if you're open and you're curious, you go like, whoa, what's that about? Now all of a sudden it's like, whoa, what's that about? Now you're being taken right to clear seeing. You see, that's a direction in which that experience is going to be held by you. You go like this and you say, judgment is a contraction and it's a dismissal and there's no openness in judgment. And so you're not going to ever see anything more than what your judgment tells you is there. But when you're saying, wow, I wonder what that's about. You don't know, but you're willing to learn. You're willing to see. Now you're wide open, and the floodgates of the universe can pour in. Molly?
I made an example of being caught up in my self-intention, like the situation at work, but now I'm separate. I'm more free from it. I'm not as entangled as I was, say, 3 weeks ago, where there was a lot of suffering and there were those thoughts of pain. So I, as you're talking, I see that the freedom that I have now that I didn't have then.
Good.
Leads away with. But I also, as simple as it sounds, it seems very difficult thinking that, like in a work situation, in a building with many people, with many histories, with many wounds and many selfies, all bombarding you at the same time. Right, it's not just me to play there, although...
No, I know.
Although I see the selfing that I have in there.
Yep.
It's a big challenge.
It's a great challenge. There's no greater challenge. That's absolutely true. And that's why we take ourselves in and out of different environments, retreats, anything that helps allow us some more stability. Because what's really happening is when you have a lot of voices coming at you with different conflicting information, is that you're getting lost in the partial answers of each one, and it's confusing. And again, you say, okay, I need to ground this confusion. I'll ground this confusion in my body, and I'll do some sitting. And so using practices that are meant to give you some space and clarity around what's coming in, and that's what really the whole practice of daily life is about, is to find the balance of what you need in order to maintain that stability of mind and body and heart, so that you can listen to these things with and to be able to process them with some degree of clarity in yourself. And that's very difficult to do. Easy for me to say, very difficult for anyone to do. Let's see if there's somebody. Yes.
You mentioned the kind of long retreats and concentration practice and the microscope, and that it's maybe not necessary. But you and many other teachers have gone through those experiences.
It was necessary. I think it was necessary for me. Because, you know why? Because I believed it to be true. And I had to prove to myself that it wasn't. So that's why it was necessary for me. It was like the woman who says, you know, I have this hole in my heart and I really desire this thing. It may be necessary for you to live that out, to see that whatever that desire is, say it's marriage, doesn't give you the satisfaction, you know, and then you can move on after that. But that's why it was necessary. And if it's, so my words shouldn't dissuade you from doing what you feel is necessary for yourself to see. You know, that's really what we're doing in spirit, is finding the end of form. Formlessness has nothing to do with practice. It pre-exists it. It pre-exists it. And so once you're finished with all of the rebuttals that you're giving your life, you then say, okay, I really want this now. And then you find a way to, it's anti-practice, really, because you're the volitional attempt to do something for yourself is gone. You realize that this is not about going somewhere, traveling somewhere, it's about receiving what's here. And those are very different ways of holding a space. When it's absence of what I need, or when I'm just not seeing and it's present, those are very different ways of working and practice. You see? So if we have it so that it's very far away and we're searching for it, then there's a lot we've got to do to prove that the search is useless. I'm not trying to be funny. I'm really trying. This is honest. And then I prove it to be useless, and that sometimes will be your entire path. And on your deathbed, maybe you'll think, God, that was useless. If you're lucky. Or okay, so maybe it's not as far away as I think it is. Let me test that hypothesis. Usually we think it's far away because we don't feel deserving of it. We feel like we have to become better, more pure, something. We've got some spiritual logic that forces a dynamic of keeping it separate from us until we can finally arrive at the place where we think we're deserving of it, which never happens, by the way. You get tired of running after it. That's what happens. And then you think, I don't give a fuck. And then it comes at you. You know, that's actually I should have put that in the book. Not the four-letter word, but everything else. No, you've asked to let other people.
Two things are, I'm thinking about two things, and I hope I'm seeing clearly. Well, like I said, it doesn't matter. In the sitting, I saw the edge of my ego, that which manifests from its, like, the core trigger, and I saw how that manifests, you know, that is the path I lead in my life and my job, and now I'm sitting here like going, okay, that's why I'm doing that too, but naturally. But so what I'm sitting with now is, okay, that is, I can't escape that. But what I can do when I have those moments of, you know, life is experience, and I'm experience the experience, and I find that place of stillness, and I am, you know, the black hole, the dark space, whatever's there, and it's scary. I don't have the inclination to stay because I feel like I don't have the muscle or the, it's not built up enough, the language or even the, well, maybe experience to say, you know, like that other voice is not strong enough to say, no, stay.
What's going to change that?
Opening my mouth right now and asking, inquiring about it. And
good.
Thinking
about good.
It.
Good. Because you have to, is that true? Yeah, well, you have to ask whether the voice that says you're not sufficient is a more true representation than the quiet that you're observing. Which is more true of you, the quiet or the noise? And the assumption, you see, when you see that the assumptions that were built upon, it's just the logic of other people's minds and us embellishing that logic to come up with our own image. And that's a conditioned, you didn't have that when you were born. When you were born, you were white, like, you were in the middle of the black hole, right? And then somehow this voice convinced you that you needed to do something in order to be deserving of it or something. So ask yourself when you're, go ahead.
Well, like, so what is it going to take for me to let that go? I can feel it in my shoulders. I know.
You don't force letting go. You allow yourself to understand yourself. You see it over and over again until it no longer convinces you of its narrative. After a while, it doesn't convince you anymore just because of the repetition of hearing it. As long as the repetition of hearing it is pure enough so that you're not adding a new layer to it as you hear it. God, there I go again. I'm always doing this. I'll forever be like this. I don't know. That's adding a new layer. But hearing it, feeling it, that's pure seeing. Okay. So I said that pure seeing was the only healing, but there are gradients to pure seeing. Like there's a little voice that says, yeah, but you still, that's okay. You know, just let your seeing be as clear as it can be and you be as sincere and it'll start clearing itself up. So you're very sincere. There's no question, dear Susan. There's no question of your sincerity. I've known you a long, long time. Now just let that sincerity has its own way with you. Okay? Just give yourself, I want this. Let that sincerity, that'll have its own movement for you. Okay. Nope. We're finished. Nope. When we're done, and I'm done. Okay, so let's just sit for a minute or two.